Hello there, I'm Chris Difford. Welcome to Series 2 of my podcast, I Never Thought It Would Happen. A podcast made in collaboration with my great friends, the amazing charity Help Musicians. In this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by a comedian, filmmaker and musician. A musician with an amazing talent for skewing pop culture, whether it's heavy metal, folk music or musical theatre. He hits the mark every time. And though it's 40 years since Spinal Tap was released, it still holds up and is still being discovered by young people around the world. Please welcome my very good friend, Mr. Christopher Guest. You look very well. Are you okay?
I'm all right. I'm here. Are you in a potting shed? What is that?
Yes, where I pot my ideas. It's down the end of the garden, so it's a bit of a wobble down the pathway when it's dark. And when it's cold, it's pretty hard work, but it's kind of got everything in here.
Tell me what this is. Tell me about what this is.
Okay, well, Mr. Christopher Guest, welcome to I Never Thought It Would Happen. It's a podcast for Help Musicians. And Help Musicians is a charity that's been going for 100 years, started by Edward Elgar and Vaughan Williams. And it was started because a violinist fell ill and died, and the family couldn't bury him because they didn't have any money. So everybody chipped in, and it became a charitable gift to the family. And musicians really didn't have a lot of money, and some of them still don't, of course. And so it's just been progressing. Last year, Help Musicians have provided £19.3 million in donations to musicians who were on their arse and finding things tough during the COVID period. Mm-hmm. And I'm still seeing that. I'm still seeing musicians turn up who have gone off to be Amazon van drivers or do something completely different. But they get a little lift, a little tickle from Help Musicians. Have you ever heard of it?
I haven't. You know, we have several groups in the States. It's not one group, but different localities have different groups. But I don't know of one overall group.
Yeah, it's worked very well. And during the lockdown, first lockdown period, I became aware of it and started to mentor some of the people out there, and I found it was really a good focusing tool while I was in the lockdown position, so to speak. So I got to meet hundreds of different musicians and songwriters and trumpet players and timpani players, all these people that just didn't have jobs. It was so sad.
Well, that's a very valuable thing, obviously. This has been a very difficult time for people all over the world and for people who obviously would had the chance to go out on tour, do shows. It's been crippling. I know many musicians who have had tours canceled, I'm sure you do as well, and only recently took it up in the last few months again. And I have to say that here in the States, it's still a bit of a strange feeling to, it's not fully back to normal. It doesn't feel like it's back to normal.
Yeah,
I haven't had a meal in a restaurant in a year and a half. But that's my choice, obviously. We have these up and down COVID situations in different cities. They have these maps that are in the newspapers and on the internet of which particular places have spikes in this thing. And
does the film industry have the same kind of backup?
Do you mean in terms of the COVID thing?
Yeah. You know, there's thousands of people that work in film, of course, you know, from T-boys upwards.
Well, people are working. People have been shooting for a long time now. They've been working for a year. The protocols that have been added to the productions are quite severe financially for them. It costs a film another $10 million just to do the protocols. People are tested every single day. People are kept apart from each other unless they're working, and it's quite severe. But in a good way, I guess, because if a star of a movie comes down with COVID, the thing shuts down and it ends up being impossible, because that could be 10 days, which would end up being many millions of dollars.
Yeah, we had the same thing when we came out to with Hall & Oates. Everybody in their crew and our crew, we all had to keep separate from each other and be tested every day. And I didn't really see any major issues until we got back to the UK and we were touring with a band called Madness. And two of the members of the crew got COVID. And then the whole lighting crew decided to go home.
Wow.
They had to find a complete new lighting crew in 4 hours.
You should have called me because I have many small torches that I could have given you. And in fact, I've got a little laser thing as well. See, it's a laser.
A laser bullet?
Well, it looks like it's not a real bullet. It's a laser pointer. And I've got a stapler.
That would have worked.
It's shiny. Elvis, as you probably heard, went on tour, and in successive weeks or something, he lost a couple of people, and then they had to fill in and eventually kind of go along. But yes, I've been laying quite low socially.
It's time to come out of the closet, I think. I don't mean it like that. I mean, go out and see your friends.
I shouldn't say entirely, and I'm on the conservative side of this, so we'll see.
I am too. I share that. So when you were a young teenager and you were living at home, was there music all over the place?
I like how you just slipped into that. Very smooth.
I went down the slide in the park. I took you from the top of the slide to the bottom.
When I was a teenager, was there music in the house, was the question?
Yeah. Were your parents musically minded?
Well, I'll go back farther than that, or further than that, or feather than that, which is I was just reading some things that my dad wrote, who is no longer with us. He wrote about his childhood during and after the First World War. My grandmother was a harpist at the Royal Academy. I have the harp here that she had in London. And my dad, in his writings, they lived in Chelsea. She would play for these salons that they would have where writers and some musicians would come over. My parents did not play instruments, but they played a lot of music. And that was generally jazz and classical music. So what I heard was a combination of Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, Tchaikovsky, and jazz, which of the time was, they were not quite up to bebop. They didn't quite get to bebop, but I heard early jazz. I heard a lot of Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong. That was what was in the house.
Glorious.
And I started expressing myself musically probably at the age of 8 or 10, maybe 8 years old. Yeah.
How did you do
that? Well, I would take down my mother's pots and pans from where they hung, and I would take implements and I would make a drum set. And that was not appreciated, I will say, because it was a rude, loud sound. And I begged for drums, but we lived in a flat in New York City and you couldn't really have a drum set in a flat because of neighbors. And then I was taken to a music school and I began to study the clarinet. Against my wishes, I didn't want to play the clarinet. I eventually did play. I'm squeezing this into a time where eventually I went to a school called the High School of Music and Art in New York City, which funneled people into the New York Philharmonic. But I pretty soon realized that that was not going to be possible. And I started playing the guitar and the mandolin while I was in high school. And we had a band in high school, and then it either evolved or devolved into what happened next, which was me playing in rock and roll bands and in bluegrass bands at the same time. And then it just kept going, I guess.
What was the attraction of rock and roll for you then?
Well, I'm older than you. I'm old enough to be your dad. So let me explain what the old days were like. You probably read about it. Rock and roll was such a departure from what was happening before. If you're studying music and you know that swing music was about as crazy as it got, that would be Benny Goodman. Yeah. And there were versions of that in England that were, you know, similar, I suppose. But hearing that for the first time, about 1956 or 57 when it was on the radio, was so wild. It really felt like someone had gone crazy. Hmm. And if you watch those early movies with Bill Haley and the Comets and those early, early groups, they put them in movies. The grown-up people who had teenagers were shocked by this. It was just not a thing. What's the matter with these people? Why are they moving like that? Little Richard was just like a Martian. It was like being injected with this excitement. Hmm. And obviously, as you know, once you start playing, I was playing both acoustic music and electric music. And electric music, because you could make it loud, and because adults didn't like that, that was also an impetus to keep turning it up. Hmm. Many years later, playing concerts, as you've done so much, in the guise of a group that we created, to big arenas that were, and it was quite loud. It was much later that they invented these in-ear monitor systems. But after doing that for 30 years, it was pretty much, as you know, I just heard the other day that, every week you read about someone else who's lost their hearing. I can hear. It's not what it was, I'm sure, but I can hear. But that was the initial excitement, playing music and playing with friends. And that excitement of playing with each other was this magical thing. And it's through these generations, and you read about, I heard for the first time, and I'd never heard this story of, this was in the early 60s when Jeff Beck had heard about another guy that he knew that was his age roughly, who had a record collection, and he had to take the tube and a bus and a tube to get to this person. Knocks on the door, person opens the door, I hear you have some records, so I have some blues records. And then they went insane sharing the things. And that was Jimmy Page.
Oh, my God. Wow.
And I had never heard that story. And you think, the more you hear about this, and it comes out in these documentaries, that there are versions, many versions of this, where someone is sharing these records that are these, at the time, records, because they had album covers, because they had notes inside, were this magical gift to people. And then you could share them and you could borrow them, and you would sit and listen. You wouldn't flip back and forth. They had a beginning, middle, and end. When you laid out an album, you were very concerned about the order of the songs. It was not some random thing. Now when people can listen to a song and just go back and forth, it's an odder thing. But then people would sit and listen to records with each other. That was a thing, sitting at a party and listening to records, sitting there and looking at these albums. I don't think I had, maybe a couple left.
But were your parents supportive? Did they come and watch you play?
Let's not go too far. You know, no one has ever asked me that. And the answer would be no, because A, I probably wouldn't have, it would have been embarrassing to have them there.
Sure, for your friends.
That would have been a nightmare. I played in London when I was living in London, and did at various points in my life. In 1966, a friend of mine would go and play in these clubs. And, you know, it was exciting to play in these clubs. And we would do that in New York City as well. But no, my parents, I don't think it never ever would have occurred to them to do that.
No, I understand that. What was the first band that you went to see when you were sort of like in your mid-teen years?
Well, let's see, how old was I at the time? I saw the Stones in 1965. They were playing in the States in a high school gym in Massachusetts. And I was going to a school, and we went, a group of us went, or were taken, however we got there. And the main thing I remember was how loud it was. You couldn't hear anything. It was just the worst acoustics in the world. It was a gymnasium. It was girls screaming. Brilliant. You couldn't hear anything.
No.
You could barely hear anything at all. I saw Dylan in 1963.
Wow, that was the opposite, I guess.
And that was the opposite. It was him by himself with an acoustic guitar in New York.
Did you feel that that was a real magical time?
Well, that was... Imagine holding the stage for an hour and a half by yourself with an acoustic guitar, whoever you are, at any time. He was just beginning. 2 years later, he would have an electric band. Mm. And I saw the Paul Butterfield Blues Band was a big influence. It was a band from Chicago with a guitar player named Mike Bloomfield.
Did they record with Dylan?
Yes, they backed him at the folk festival in 65 where people booed him because he was playing electric.
Electric, yeah.
And the people running that festival were going to cut the wires because they thought this was a blasphemy because everyone else was playing acoustic music. I saw a lot of blues bands. I saw people like B.B. King and Albert King when I was probably 16, 17.
Oh, my God.
And Blood, Sweat, and Tears. I never saw The Who. I saw Wilson Pickett at the Apollo Theater before it had been redone in 1967. Uh-huh. I saw a lot of jazz as well. I went to a lot of different kinds of music and played different kinds of music. But as you know, there's something different about music from anything else. I make movies and I've been an actor in movies and I write movies. But there's nothing compared to playing music. And I've been lucky to go on tours and play the Albert Hall and Carnegie Hall and play places. And there's nothing like that. There's just nothing like that, I guess.
Seeing those people like Dylan, did you have an ambition to want to be a songwriter?
I don't think it really ever occurred to me. It was fun to play music until I met a longtime friend now, Michael McKean. We were at university together. We were 18 years old.
Where was that?
That was New York's School of the Arts. It was part of New York University. It's called something else now. We were intending to be actors, it turned out. And I saw this other guy with long hair. We had long hair. This is before people had gray hair. Well, people had gray hair, but we didn't. And I saw a guy with a hat, long hair, and carrying a guitar, and I had a guitar. And we looked at each other, and the first thing is, what do you like? Who do you do the thing? And within a week, we were writing songs together.
Wow.
And you know how that is when you're young and those floodgates open. And he eventually, when he broke up with his girlfriend, we shared an apartment. We were still going to university and would play all night and write songs. Some of those I still remember. Some of them, when we get together for Spinal Tap reunions, we still play and can remember the words. And then it evolved, and this is where it doesn't apply really to anybody else, which is when I guess I was still in my early 20s when I started writing what would be described as satirical music, I suppose, for the National Lampoon and making records. And then eventually that morphed into Spinal Tap. I get to do everything. I get to play a person, a different person, a character, and I get to play music and write music specifically for that purpose. And that is kind of what I do, I guess.
Yeah. So you didn't have sort of ambitions to be in a band with Michael and go on tour and that sort of thing?
Michael and I toured in a band called Lenny and the Squiggy Tones in 1979. In 1966, I toured with a bluegrass group, and that's a whole other story. I played many shows in New York with the band in the 60s, but those were to make money. They were at parties, they were at events where we got these gigs to just play, and you would go. I had a band with a friend called Voltaire's Nose in 1967. Which at the time we thought was amusing. No one else found it amusing. They found it confusing because they didn't know who Voltaire was, it turned out. And we would play some original songs and some cover songs. And then I guess it just evolved into this other thing. And then eventually, ironically, for Spinal Tap, we did many tours over 30 years. We did toured all over the United States and Europe and Australia and wherever, playing these big venues where you find yourself. I came across a picture of us at Wembley, the original Wembley, and then the new Wembley, and how surreal it always was to walk out to 70,000 people and play these shows. We always used to talk afterwards and think, what are they thinking? Because it's not as if we're playing for 10 minutes. We're playing for 2 hours when we do these shows. There are no jokes in the shows, per se. There are no, you know.
It's just serious stuff.
But the movie has come to life, and now they get to see the people from the movie, and now you're playing these songs, and they know most of them, and they're singing along. We played Glastonbury, and there were probably 120,000 people, and they're holding up these little Stonehenge things. And you're looking out, I'm sure you've been there, over this vast field from that main stage and thinking it's always the most surreal thing, because after the show, the person you see, and then we're going to a restaurant and just having a meal, we're a different person. And we're talking about a book we've read, or we're doing something else. We're not going back to a hotel and throwing the television off the balcony. In a way, we got to have the best of everything, really, I suppose.
You certainly did, and I don't think there's a band that I've met that have not quoted Spinal Tap. I was with a young band the last couple of days from Cumbria. They're like 17-year-olds, and they said, have you seen Spinal Tap?
It's almost 40 years ago. And
that's extraordinary.
We are talking about the possibility of doing another project. I haven't been telling the public about, although now I guess I am, although we don't know whether we're going to do it or not, but we're talking about some potential thing in the next year. The fun of it was playing the music and having the excuse to then play and write songs with Michael and Harry. It's just very eerie, because then you realize that you're actually getting to do this, and at this high level where you've never had to open for anyone.
Yeah.
And it was only about 5 or 6 years ago that we started opening for ourselves. We were playing The Folksman, which is in a movie I did called A Mighty Wind about folk music. And we were playing a sad old folk group. And we thought, wouldn't this be great if we came out as those guys and did 5 songs? We know it would be unpopular. And that would be amazing, because then we'd get that feeling. And if it's done well, you'd feel that. And we did. And at a show we did, I think it was at the Greek Theater in Los Angeles, my son was about 6 at the time, and he was sitting next to my wife, and he said, when are the old guys getting off and the loud guys coming on? Because no one recognized us. None of the Tap fans knew it was. And to feel that palpable hatred for who the fuck, why the hell are these people up there? It was just blissful in its badness, in a way. Yeah. And we played Wembley Arena, and that's where it got really kind of tense, where we thought, we don't know if we can even get through the 5 songs because you are feeling these, you know, x-rays get the fuck off the stage thing. And then it was just high fives that we were on stage, because we did it. We did it multiple times. We did it at Carnegie Hall as well.
Stop counting nuts, you should have said.
Anyway, so my situation, I've been very fortunate to get to play music and play as a different person, because the way that, I mean, this, not to get too weird about this, but the way that the character Nigel Tufnel plays is not the way that I would play. I mean, that's sort of over the top, and it's kind of pretentious, and the songs are pretentious. Hmm. But that was fun to do, to inhabit those people, and then to play and to have people, I guess, appreciate it for so long.
Did you have special guests like Jeff Beck? I know you're a friend of his.
Jeff played on one of our albums. We would have people in different cities. Mm-hmm. Jeff came to the show at the Albert Hall, but he didn't want to come on stage, I think, because people had said to him early, well, he's doing you. And I wasn't doing him at all. It had nothing to do with that. I don't know where people got that from, but it had nothing to do with him. But yes, we did have some people play with us when we toured in the States, especially in a given city, someone would come up and play with us. And then it was kind of crossing these realities, I suppose, in some way, because the band people that we would meet in your life, you go through your life, and I know a lot of musicians, and they would say, well, wait a minute. On our bus, we watch Spinal Tap. What do you guys watch when you're on your bus? And I said, well, we're watching Blackadder. And it was this weird kind of cultural cross where we'd heard for 20, 30 years that people had watched Spinal Tap on their buses. And there we are watching Blackadder on our tour bus, you know. And so it was a, we're obviously not going to watch ourselves. I mean, that wouldn't make any sense.
Alongside my guests in each episode, we also like to feature the story of a musician who has benefited from Help Musicians and whose career has been supported or even saved by the charity.
My name is Leah Shaw. I am an opera singer based up in Glasgow. I work primarily with Scottish opera at the moment, but my interests range from the classical canon all the way to very, very recently composed works. I mean, I've always been really into music. I mean, my parents were both very supportive of me and whatever we wanted to do. And between them, they both played instruments and were very interested in music, although neither of them were professional musicians. But between both of them, they had loads and loads of different kind of musical input, everything from Rachmaninoff to bossa nova, like everything. So our house was always full of music. But in terms of music, I think where it really changed for me was we saw a production of Turandot at the Met when I was maybe 5 or 6 or 7. And I just thought, oh my God, I want to do that. I want to wear the costumes. I want to tell the stories. Like, I want to be in that environment with the lights and the orchestra below me and everything. It's been a series of high points, really. I mean, it's hard to pinpoint one exact kind of moment. I mean, getting my job as an emerging artist at Scottish Opera, that's something that I could have only dreamed of a few years ago, and now apparently that's happening. And shortly going to be making my main stage debut with them in Midsummer Night's Dream. So I'm constantly in awe of where this journey is taking me. Help Musicians is such a supportive organisation. It's almost like a mother organization for musicians in almost every aspect. Like, I am so grateful for their support. I wouldn't have been able to finish my degree or undertake any of my masters without their help. I first heard about Help Musicians from a colleague of mine, that they were just mentioning that they were doing the rounds for funding applications for masters, PhDs and stuff. And I said, ah, what other types of funding do they do? And they said, oh, well, they do loads. Like, look up their website and see. Just the fact that they are open to almost any proposal, like they'll figure out a way to help you if they can. So if anyone was wondering about maybe approaching Help Musicians but thought that it wasn't for them, or maybe they shouldn't or couldn't because it's not okay to admit that you need help, I would say just do it. Come with all of your bruises and your foibles and really just ask for help, because if they can, they will give it. And I think that's a kind of rare experience. We're so used to an environment where we're not necessarily always appreciated, always valued, even though the work that we do to make this world beautiful is invaluable, and it would be felt sorely if we lost it. Without music, our world would be so quiet and it would be so two-dimensional. Music and the arts are so important in bringing a kind of three-dimensionality to our world. They help articulate our emotional state and our kind of wants and our desires in a way that words definitely fail.
To discover more about the amazing work that Help Musicians do, then look out for them on all social media platforms or go to their website at helpmusicians.org. Has music always been a bit of a hobby?
Well, we made money doing music, and I've made a lot of records over the years of different descriptions. I've made probably 10 records, many different types of records.
Is there a record in you, do you think, that isn't Nigel Tufnell and isn't The Folksman?
I record music probably 2 or 3 times a week here in my little studio at home. And as you know, with modern capabilities, you can really do everything. So I put down string parts and orchestral parts, and I play live guitar parts and mandolin parts and bass parts, and I sing, and they're all for me. They're not for anyone else to hear.
Right.
I give them to my wife, but I'm not going to make a record out of that. I did a record with a friend that was kind of meditative music some years ago. It's called the Bayman Brothers, and it's not funny music. It's just kind of, I guess it's meditation music or something like that. But no, I'm not going to write real love songs, and no, I'm not going to do that. But I love recording music and playing music every day.
That, to me, sounds like a hobby. It's like me coming here and writing lyrics. It's, for me, it's a hobby. And if they become something else, then that's
a gift. It has been part of my living over many years, so I wouldn't call it I think a hobby, without getting into the word game of it, is really something where you don't make a living off of it. I've made a living off of many different things, films and Spinal Tap, playing music in various ways. So I wouldn't call it a hobby, but I play it at home. No one's paying me to do this at home. So I think a hobby for me is when I tithe fishing flies. That's a hobby. I'm not selling them to anyone. I give them to people.
That's lovely, yeah. So have you ever thought of musical theater? Has that ever attracted you?
Well, I'll direct your attention to a film I made called Waiting for Guffman.
Well, I was going to get to that, yeah.
Which is about, for people who haven't seen it, it's about a small town theater company that has delusions of grandeur, just to make it simple. And I play a director who fancies himself a person with more talent than he actually has, shall we say. That's what the film is about. And they put on a show. Real musical theater, I find challenging. The question you asked, which is a good one, is, and people said to me when I did a show called Lemmings in New York, we wrote a show which was me and the cast and the rest of the people. I wrote the music with another person, and we wrote satirical rock songs. This was 1973. And people would come back and say, wow, that was really cool. How did you get the rights to do the music? What do you mean? Well, the James Taylor song. Yeah, that was a song I wrote, actually. It's not a James Taylor melody. It's a melody that's meant to evoke that, or the Bob Dylan song I did, or the Crosby, Stills, and Nash song we did, or whatever. But clearly, at that age, in my early 20s, I was veering off into what would be, and that was my living. I was making money making these records and working at the National Lampoon, which was a humor magazine, doing music. Again, it happened to be music that was, I guess, the music itself wasn't funny. And it gets into an area which is a narrow area. But when you write songs and have written songs, those are songs of many different types, but they can be funny within the song or clever, but they're not in the humor bin in a record store.
No.
Not that people do this anymore. Well, they do this if they're digging.
But like Stephen Sondheim, who I've become a huge fan of in the last 5 or 10 years, such a clever lyricist and such a clever person when he writes.
Yes, and obviously that's a different... I mean, think about how young he was when he did West Side Story. I think he was 19 or something like that.
Really? Yeah, I guess he was.
Crazy. And he was writing this, one of the most brilliant musicals ever written with Leonard Bernstein.
Yeah.
And he obviously then went on, and that's a whole other, even within the categorization of the world he was on another level.
Yeah.
I find it, and I don't look at his music this way, but I look at a lot of musicals, it's hard for me to get past the largeness of the performances and how unreal it is, I suppose. Even though the music itself can be brilliant, I find that taking it out of the reality of the moment, that when people are talking and then they start to sing, obviously you'd say, well, that's kind of the point. It is the point. And I was taken to musicals as a child in New York City. I was taken to My Fair Lady when I was probably 8 or 10, the original one.
Wow.
On Broadway. I vividly remember walking into this theater and hearing the orchestra. That's when they could afford having an orchestra in the pit. Now it's 5 people with
keyboards.
keyboards and a computer, and this guy's doing the strings and this person's doing the horn section. It was a full orchestra, and I remember hearing them warming up, walking down and looking down and thinking, oh, this is amazing. They're going to play live music. And all I could hear was the music. I could only hear the music. I couldn't pay attention to the words, the lyrics at all. Not a good thing to say to you, obviously.
But is there sort of a musical theatre genre that you lean towards that you would like? I mean, a lot of it is very difficult to grasp, I think. It's not like pop music that invites you in.
I would put it rather that there are certain musicals that I love, and they're typically things that have been done a long time ago. Now, if you look at Hamilton, that was an incredibly bold event to think about knocking down all those stereotypes and the doors and the rest of it, to have people of color playing the equivalent of saying, I'm going to have a black person playing Benjamin Disraeli or something. And I'm trying to look for some, or Henry VIII. Or now people do this more, and you see these things in films. But a musical like Guys and Dolls, which is very old, from the 50s, still works. The music is amazing. The man wrote the music and the lyrics, which is insane. Think about that. Oliver is a thing, obviously. I'm obsessed with Charles Dickens and read him all the time. And that is very evocative to me because of the story, obviously coming from the book, but also the darkness of that story. Yeah. And the songs are just incredible.
Yeah.
There are certain things, I would rather put it that there are certain things that strike, and then there's certain things that I don't understand. I just don't. And now they're doing this in movies all the time. I watched one the other night. I'm a member of the Academy, and so we get to vote on these films. And I watched this movie, Cyrano, which I don't know where it was actually shot, but I think it's an English director, I think.
I haven't heard of that one.
No. And that is typical of a new kind of musical that moves in and out of a practical location with dance and people of different stripes playing different parts and the rest of it. Now, I truthfully, and I saw this only a few days ago, I don't know if I could sing one of those songs to you right now.
No, it's not like The Sound of Music or a Chitty Chitty Bang.
Well, and that is, I find that I'm an outlier in the sense that people, and I will say to people, and this is true, I've never seen The Sound of Music. I've seen scenes from The Sound of Music, and I've heard a song or two, but I've never sat and watched the whole movie because I don't know if I could get through it.
Right, okay. So when you're putting a film together, is it like putting a song together? Is there a verse, a chorus, a middle eight, and a verse?
Well, you being a master songwriter know that for different people it works in different ways. When you were writing initially as a young person and you and Glenn were writing, and it would kind of be this back and forth thing, and if you read how that was done, and I happen to know you, so I also know how it was done, but all these partnerships, if they are partnerships, work in different ways, where someone may come up with a lyric and someone may come and then it builds and there's no routine that's the same for everyone. When I do my films, which are different than the way other people do their films, I come up with an idea. Some idea would strike me. And then I would say, okay, I happen to like working with a collaborator. So I've written movies with chiefly one other person, Eugene Levy. And it usually takes about 6 months just to write out the story. Mm-hmm. So it's quite different. But then you have to break down every single scene. So there are 100 cards on a wall or more, which delineate every single scene, what happens in every single scene. And there's a beginning, middle, and an end. This isn't some random thing. We know the whole scope of this. So there are things in common, but in the sense of a song, and you know this, certain songs come to you very quickly.
Right.
In 10 minutes. And it's not to say that that's a bad song. It could be one of the great songs you ever wrote. It's just you wake up and you say, this is the thing, and here's the thing, and now it happens. So, that can't happen with a movie. You can't write a movie in 10 minutes.
But like something like Curb Your Enthusiasm, it strikes me that maybe that's done in a similar way, where they have the outline of what's going to happen.
And well, this was the beginning of that mechanism began with Spinal Tap. because no other film or anything else had been done in that way, where we, the four of us, wrote out this story and were about to start writing the dialogue. And we said, wait a minute, this is going to be much more funny if this is meant to be a documentary and we're improvising it on camera, which we did. And people say, I don't understand. And I say, well, we knew what happened in every scene, but we didn't know what we were going to say. How does that work? Well, as you know, and if I'm playing with friends and we pick up instruments, someone can start to play and now you're just playing along and someone says, well, how do you know what to play? And you say, well, I don't know. I just took a solo, but it's not written down anywhere. I just soloed. I made a solo. And then the same thing, people, and I've been talking about this for years, where someone will say, well, how do you, when you rehearse? And I say, well, we don't rehearse. There is no rehearsal. No. People know what happens in the scene. They know what key we're playing in. And they know the melody, meaning the story, but they don't know the notes.
Yeah. So Mike Lee, who's an English filmmaker, he has a similar kind of thing. I remember stopping at a services just off the M4 near Heathrow, and he was sitting in his car observing two of his actors who were having a cup of coffee.
When we are shooting a movie, everyone knows the background of who they are, where they came from, mm-hmm. their first boyfriend, blah, 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 the rest of it. And I say, action.
And off you go.
In his method, the actors will improvise what is eventually to become the scene. And then it's a different way of working and it's an interesting way of working, but that's not what I do. And that's not what we did in Spinal Tap.
Right.
Okay. And you need the people that can do that. You can't just pull people off the street and say, you're now in a movie and now you're talking.
No.
And there's no way to explain this anymore. It is in that analogy with someone taking a solo, a guitar solo.
So are you a fan of recent music like Billie Eilish and Beyoncé? I mean, there's just so many people I could quote.
I wouldn't make a generalization. There are certain people I hear that I think are amazing. Mm-hmm. And there are certain people I don't respond to in the same way in any era. Going back to when I first started hearing music, I wouldn't make a blanket statement and say, are you a fan of what's happening now? I'm a fan. There's great talent in every era. Incredible talent, gifted people that are singers, writers, performers. But I wouldn't say as an overall generalization, I can't say that. Thankfully, and it's true with actors and people who write movies and painters and the rest, that they're and guitar players, they are great people in every generation and they keep that going. And thank God, because otherwise this world would be, it's in a dangerous place right now. And you get to mentor many younger people and they can look up to what you've done because you have this vast library of work that you've done over the years. And it's so solid. And a good musician will look at that and realize how solid the songwriting is. That will continue into the future. There are people writing today where in the future people look back and say, wow, the construction of that is great. And then there's shit out there. There's always will be. And most of it is, I guess. And it's the same proportion, I think, through the ages where people will say, oh, well, in the 60s, everyone was good. No, they weren't. There were 15 good bands and there were 3,000 shit bands. I mean, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
That your memory tends to... Oh, yeah, well, look, they had The Who and they had The Stones and they had The Beatles and they had, and you say, yeah, but you're forgetting all the other stuff. You're forgetting Vanilla Fudge.
Vanilla Fudge.
And Strawberry Alarm Clock.
Absolutely.
And all these groups where you go, no offense, but you just think, well, those don't have a legacy where you're saying, wow, they each had 100 songs. For me, it's more about the bands or the individuals. And I think they're great people through the ages that happen, and thankfully.
Yeah. So with COVID sort of still around, but not as prevalent as it once was, do you have, and I don't need to get into it at all, but do you have plans to make more work for yourself?
It's a good question, I think. I think I'm uncertain about that.
Oh, okay.
I'm uncertain, and it's not because of COVID or not because of COVID. It's because I think I'm living a different life now. As I mentioned earlier, I'm contemplating doing some work with this group of friends that I work with it's a massively big undertaking. It would require a year and a half of work.
Yeah.
And I don't know yet if that's a thing or not. I know what it takes to do that, and I'm not sure.
Yeah, I understand totally.
But I hope to see you someday soon when people can go and see people play and not have to wear a mask. And I've known you for, I don't know how long, have I known you for 20 years?
Yes.
Okay. Well, when I first met you and first saw you, and I've seen you play, I saw you play in a record shop once, just the two of you.
That's right. Yeah.
I was working in London and I was thinking, oh, he said, we're doing this thing. And this huge storm outside. And I'm thinking, And I remember walking to this gig. Well, it was a giglet. And I've seen you subsequently many times over the years in different places. And I remember thinking, that was amazing. Walking back with my umbrella through the streets and thinking, that was just, wow, just the two of them, just there. And I saw you play in Greenwich, up on that hill in that place. It was just the two of you, but walking in the rain. And the funny part about that, it was so vital because you're naked. It was just the two of you. You're not hiding behind anything. There's no, you know, smoke bombs. There's nothing. And you're hearing singing and writing and playing. And then I went back to the States, and the shoes I was wearing had mold on the bottom from walking in the rain to that gig. Actual mold was growing
on
the bottom of the shoes.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry.
That's funny. I don't remember those gigs particularly, but you know.
I'll refresh your memory as you wish. No, because you did so much work and over so many years that it would all start to blend in. And as you know, even the touring that we did, and we did a lot of these big tours, weirdly enough, where you're in a place and you don't even know where you are. And I remember being in a hotel and waking up and thinking that horribly scary feel of thinking, I don't know where I am. And in that day and age where you could actually look over and see something on the nightstand and it had some thing, it was Atlanta. And I looked out the window thinking, that's a scary thought.
That is a scary thought. Yeah.
The amount of work you did, it would be not surprising you wouldn't remember that.
I looked at my diary today for 1972, which is 50 years ago. And on this day in 1972, I went to a place called Avery Hill College. And there was a guy called David Bowie playing. And the audience sat cross-legged on the floor, which is what they used to do in those days. We sat on the floor. I was in the second row. In walks this skinny guy with his 12-string guitar. And then the band come on a bit later and he plays all these wonderful songs. And then he hands you the guitar. And it was like an orb. It was like an orb. He handed me the guitar.
Because?
Because he just came off the stage and gave it to people. But he gave it to me first. And on the walk home to my council estate, which was 5 miles, got back at 3 a.m, I just thought, I want to do that. That's a great job that bloke's got. I want to be David Bowie.
First of all, it's great that you have a diary. I don't have a diary. Sporadically, I kept a diary. There are 25-year intervals. But I think that's amazing, and that would be great for you to publish at some point.
I'll just stand up and show you. Where is it? Here it is. Excuse me, leaning forward. Okay, so that's 1972. That's me as a hippie. And my handwriting is just ludicrous, if you can see any of that.
I can't see it closely enough to tell. You can take a picture of that and send a picture to me.
I will.
So I can see an example of that. What a lovely thing to be able to look through that. And that would be good to publish for people. I would find that really interesting.
Well, except it says things like, got up, had a bath, went to the pub.
That's the best part. What are you talking about? That's the best part of that.
Picked up the guitar, wrote a couple of songs, went back to the pub, fell asleep.
That's the title of it.
Christopher Guest, thank you so much for your time. You're such a generous man.
Thank you. Love you. And I hope to see you in the flesh.
That will be gorgeous. So I'm going to stop it now.
Yes, I'm going to stop at 2. I'm leaving.
Okay. See you soon. Chris is always great company and such a smart chap. A keen student of popular music, you could say. It's always great catching up with Chris, and I hope he gets round to making a new film very soon. We've got quite a few things in common, but I've never been in a band who have supported my own band and got booed off at the same time. To find out more about the wonderful work Help Musicians do, have a look at their website for loads more information, and please subscribe to this podcast. Thank you once again for listening. Please keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Give Me Sugar production for Help Musicians.